human greatness is a matter of scale and glitter, then no doubt Alexander the Great is at the apex of human greatness. But is greatness that? Isn't a great man, rather, one who in a great position, or amidst great opportunities and great gifts, are no more than great opportunities, serves God and his fellows with a humble heart? And quite a number of these Americans of the revolutionary time do seem to have displayed much disinterestedness and devotion. They were limited men, fallible men. Washington was, for example, a conspicuously indolent man, but on the whole they seemed to have cared more for the common weal they were creating than for any personal end or personal vanity. They were all limited men. They were limited in knowledge and outlook. They were limited by the limitations of the time, and there was no perfect man among them. They were, like all of us, men of mixed motives. Good impulses arose in their minds, great ideas swept through them, and also they could be jealous, lazy, obstinate, greedy, vicious. If one were to write a true, full, and particular history of the making of the United States, it would have to be written with charity and high spirits as a splendid comedy. And in no other regard do we find the rich, tortuous humanity of the American story so finely displayed as in regard to slavery. Slavery, having regard to the general question of labor, is the test of this new soul in the world's history, the American soul. Slavery began very early in the European history of America, and no European people who went to America can be held altogether innocent in the matter. At a time when the German is still the moral whipping boy of Europe, it's well to note that the German record is in this respect the best of all. Almost the first outspoken utterances against Negro slavery came from German settlers in Pennsylvania. But the German settler was working with free labor upon a temperate countryside, well north of the plantation zone. He wasn't under serious temptation in this matter. American slavery began with the enslavement of Indians for gang work in mines and upon plantations, and it's curious to note that it was a very good and humane man indeed, Las Casas, who urged that Negroes should be brought to America to relieve his tormented Indian protégés. The need for labor upon the plantations of the West Indies and the South was imperative. When the supply of Indian captives proved inadequate, the planters turned not only to the Negro, but to the jails and poorhouses of Europe for a supply of toilers. The reader of Defoe's Moll Flanders will learn how the business of Virginian white slavery looked to an intelligent Englishman in the early 18th century. But the Negro came very early. The year, 1620, that saw the Pilgrim Fathers landing at Plymouth in New England, saw a Dutch sloop disembarking the first cargo of Negroes at Jamestown in Virginia. Negro slavery was as old as New England. It had been an American institution for over a century and a half before the War of Independence. It was to struggle on for the better part of a century more. But the conscience of thoughtful men in the colonies was never quite easy upon this score, and it was one of the accusations of Thomas Jefferson against the Crown and Lords of Great Britain that every attempt to ameliorate or restrain the slave trade on the part of the colonists had been checked by the great proprietary interests in the mother country. With the moral and intellectual ferment of the Revolution, the question of Negro slavery came right into the foreground of the public conscience. The contrast and the challenge glared upon the mind. "All men are by nature free and equal," said the Virginia Bill of Rights. And outside, in the sunshine, under the whip of the overseer, toiled the Negro slave. It witnesses to the great change in human ideas since the Roman imperial system dissolved under the barbarian inrush that there could be this heart-searching. Conditions of industry, production, and land tenure had long prevented any recrudescence of gang slavery, but now the cycle had come round again, and there were enormous immediate advantages to be reaped by the owning and ruling classes in the revival of that ancient institution, in mines, upon plantations, and upon great public works. It was revived, but against great opposition. From the beginning of the revival, there were protests, and they grew. The revival was counter to the new conscience of mankind. In some respects, the new gang slavery was worse than anything in the ancient world. Peculiarly horrible was the provocation by the trade of slave wars and man-hunts in Western Africa and the cruelties of the long transatlantic voyage. The poor creatures were packed on the ships, often with insufficient provision of food and water, without proper sanitation, without medicines. Many who could tolerate slavery upon the plantations found the slave trade too much for their moral digestions. Three European nations were chiefly concerned in this dark business: Britain, Spain, and Portugal, because they were the chief owners of the new lands in America. The comparative innocence of the other European powers is to be ascribed largely to their lesser temptations. They were similar communities. In parallel circumstances, they would have behaved similarly. Throughout the middle part of the 18th century, there was an active agitation against Negro slavery in Great Britain as well as in the States. It was estimated that in 1770 there were 15,000 slaves in Britain, mostly brought over by their owners from the West Indies and Virginia. In 1771 the issue came to a conclusive test in Britain before Lord Mansfield. A Negro named James Somerset had been brought to England from Virginia by his owner. He ran away, was captured, and violently taken on a ship to be returned to Virginia. From the ship he was extracted by a writ of habeas corpus. Lord Mansfield declared that slavery was a condition unknown to English law, an odious condition, and Somerset walked out of the court a free man. The Massachusetts Constitution of 1780 had declared that all men are born free and equal. A certain Negro, Quarko, put this to the test in 1783, and in that year the soil of Massachusetts became like the soil of Britain, intolerant of slavery. To tread upon it was to become free. At that time no other state in the Union followed this example. At the census of 1790, Massachusetts alone, of all the states, returned no slaves. The state of opinion in Virginia is remarkable because it brings to light the peculiar difficulties of the southern states. The great Virginian statesmen, such as Washington and Jefferson, condemned the institution. Yet because there was no other form of domestic service, Washington owned slaves. There was, in Virginia, a strong party in favor of emancipating slaves, but they demanded that the emancipated slaves should leave the state within a year or be outlawed. They were naturally alarmed at the possibility that a free, barbaric black community, many of its members African-born and reeking with traditions of cannibalism and secret and dreadful religious rites, should arise beside them upon Virginian soil. When we consider that point of view, we can understand why it was that a large number of Virginians should be disposed to retain the mass of blacks in the country under control as slaves, while at the same time they were bitterly opposed to the slave trade and the importation of any fresh blood from Africa. The free blacks, one sees, might easily become a nuisance. Indeed, the free state of Massachusetts presently closed its borders to their entry. The question of slavery, which in the ancient world was usually no more than a question of status between individuals racially akin, merged in America with the different and profounder question of relationship between two races at opposite extremes of the human species and of the most contrasted types of tradition and culture. If the black man had been white, there can be little doubt that Negro slavery, like white servitude, would have vanished from the United States within a generation of the Declaration of Independence, as a natural consequence of the statements in that declaration. Seventh, we've told of the War of Independence in America as the first great breakaway from the system of European monarchies and foreign offices, as the repudiation by a new community of Machiavellian statescraft as the directive form of human affairs. Within a decade there came a second and much more portentous revolt against this strange game of great powers, this tangled interaction of courts and policies which obsessed Europe.